Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Is Facebook more harmful than helpful? Has Facebook maintained their promise to create a more open and connected world in the wake of data breaches and the proliferation of fake news and disinformation? Frontline is attempting to answer those questions as they premiere a new two-part documentary this week called The Facebook Dilemma. The first hour aired last night. You can see hour two tonight, 9 Central, 8 Mountain, on SDPB TV. Here to tell us more about The Facebook Dilemma is Frontline producer Anya Borg. Anya, thank you for joining us on In the Moment.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to catch viewers and listeners up on some of the things from last night's program and then preview tonight's. But this begins last night with the very early footage of Mark Zuckerberg sort of kicking back with a beer, celebrating the beginning, a pair of shorts, celebrating the beginning of what, and you get the sense, if you ever forgot, of just how young he was when this all started. Take us back to some of the early days of Mark Zuckerberg and the founding of Facebook so that we have an idea of what they built on top of that foundation.
Well, you know, as Mark Zuckerberg often refers back to it, this really was his dorm room project that has grown into a platform for 2.2 billion people. So I think it's interesting to remember that just 14 years ago, these were a bunch of kids who I think set out in a very idealistic way to create what they thought would be the greatest experiment in free speech. And, you know, I hope that that video, that early video of them, came across as, you know, as an opportunity to kind of think a little bit about how can we be better prepared to think about the unintended consequences early on and not as an attempt to, point out that they were young or reckless.
Right, right. But there are some of the things as we sort of see, see the culture with which they surround themselves with. And it's this, you know, move fast and break things. People are too careful, apologize later. And it's really, how deep is the sense of the mission within the organization? How important is the language that they're using as they are continuing to build a business model out of nothing, really?
Well, I think it's changed. I mean, the mission has changed as well as the way in which people talk about it. But our reporting found that, you know, people really genuinely believed in the mission from the beginning of the company. And then in many ways, I think much of the early years were just driven singularly by the mission. In fact, when the company went public, Mark Zuckerberg put out in one of his statements that, you know, they didn't even know how they were going to make money, if they could be a money-making entity. I think that they really believed that the original mission was making the world more open and connected. And then in recent years, they changed it to building communities and bringing people closer together. The idea behind that being that the mission should have kind of an inherent positive outcome, that open and connected wasn't necessarily better. And I think that is actually where we found ourselves in many ways. But the folks that we interviewed really believed deeply, particularly at the outset, that this was going to make the world a better place. And that was borne out in some of the stories that you know, we saw reported, and I think the news media contributed in some respects to not covering technology in general and social media in particular in more critical and thoughtful ways. We were just all so excited about the, you know, products that people were making and this idea that there was a place, a place in Silicon Valley where there was all of this innovation and excitement. I think there was a reluctance on the part of the Obama administration to do anything to contain what was the great engine of the American economy.
Right.
So we've all, I think, been thinking a little bit more critically in the past few years about what has become a big industry like any other.
Yeah. So when you mentioned the Obama administration, some of this has to do with the Communications Decency Act. Tell me about the role of that and how it sort of intersected with this new, you know, this new platform, this new business model, this you know, new thing that people are grabbing onto, and then the existing laws and policies as they existed.
Well, in the mid-90s, there was an effort to kind of think about how are we going to regulate the internet, because it was a new thing. And one of the important bases of social media and the internet as we know it is something called Section 240, which essentially says that internet platforms are not liable for the content that is on their site. So they're the vessel. And that liability has allowed the internet to grow and prosper. You know, it's why we can rent a house on Airbnb. It's why we can post something on Facebook. It's why the internet is what it is. However, there's been this, I think, from our reporting, there's been this sense that folks at a lot of these platforms just didn't think of themselves as responsible for the content on their sites. And that has had a lot of unintended consequences, I think, at this stage that we need to rethink to some degree.
Let's go back to 2011 and the Arab Spring, Cairo, Egypt, and you take us there in hour one of the Facebook dilemma. And how does Facebook become an integral part of those gatherings in the streets, the way people are communicating? Because it seems like it's one thing, and then there's a twist.
Yeah, the Arab Spring was such an interesting story because we thought of it all, and I think the way in which it was covered in the West, we kind of just heard one side of the story, which was that social media and Facebook in particular was really a place that enabled people to communicate and to gather and to unite, and it was this mobilizing force for the revolution across the Middle East, and particularly in Egypt. So we interviewed Wael Ghanim, who was a Google engineer at the time, and actually created a Facebook page. We don't actually have time to get into it in the film, but it's an interesting story in which he came across one night a post of a young man about his age who had been beaten by the police in Egypt, and was really horrified and upset. And so he created a Facebook page, an anonymous page, to say, essentially, just to be critical of the government of Hosni Mubarak. And then after the protests in Tunisia, there was a real sense that something was spreading. And so he, somewhat on a whim, posted, "Let's gather in the streets," in January. And there was already a budding movement in Egypt, so this wasn't coming out of nowhere. But Facebook played a real important role. And Wael talked about that at the time, gave numerous interviews where he talked about how his the activism and the revolution couldn't have happened without Facebook. And I think Facebook was openly kind of reluctant at the time to claim too much credit for that. They were wise to kind of have a wait-and-see attitude. But based on our reporting from a lot of folks who were inside the company at the time, there was clearly an overwhelming sense of pride and excitement that there were such amazing real-world consequences, and in this case, what seemed to be such good consequences from the platform. And the twist was that after the revolution, something that many people didn't know, and Wael sort of takes us through, there started to be other, kind of warning signs on Facebook of what was happening both in the real world and online, kind of early signs of polarization, people using a platform to attack one another. It was just, and what's interesting about that is that one of the critics and the kind of early, people that was early on saying, hey, we need to really think about this and actually consider whether we can tweak some of the incentives in the way Facebook works was Wael himself. Yeah. So he's just this incredibly thoughtful person.
Yeah, he says they're not separating what is good and what is bad. They just look at engagement metrics, and he says, his warnings were largely ignored in some ways. There are others who come forward and say, you've got a little problem here. And are people inside Facebook failing to take it seriously? Are they taking it seriously, but then, trying to sort of manage the, external optics of it? How are they responding to some of the early voices who say, this is one of the consequences. You need to pay attention. Look over here.
You know, it's difficult because this was sort of a reporting challenge for us. So we were able to talk to people who said, yes, I heard about these kinds of things. I brought it up the line to my superiors, but it was hard for us to do a level of accountability reporting on this that, you know, we couldn't figure out where the buck stopped or where the message stopped. And I think the truth is not one so much of duplicity, but just a young company with not enough people and the reality that these are just enormous problems. I mean, I hope that what comes through in the film is that no one could have anticipated this. I mean, you have billions of people on a platform. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong. And so I think it would have been, certainly wise for Facebook to have been thinking about all of these things earlier. But the real challenge is what could they have done and what will they be able to do now? These are really vexing problems.
Well, so here's one of the things that, you know, going back to the very beginning, when they talk about, you know, who was, you know, on the ground floor, and there are a lot of the same kind of people. And I know we had on the show the author of Brotopia, and she was talking about how surprised, you know, some of the founders of these platforms were that women were treated, so poorly. There was such, you know, online harassment and trolling, and they were genuinely shocked by it. And one of her points was, well, you didn't have anybody at the table whose life experience would have clearly said, absolutely, now wait a minute, I know what's going to happen if you give people this kind of access. So is there a sense that they had a naivete, a lack of diversity and life experience that sort of opened the door for some of those? I mean, I agree with you, it's so huge, you know, how could they have ever foreseen? But there were some things, if you were starting out today, you might do differently.
I think it was all of those things. It was everything you mentioned.
Yeah.
It was an insular culture. It was, you know, Silicon Valley is really a bubble. There was absolutely a lack of people who were thinking early on about all the ways in which the platform could be manipulated or used for harm. There was just a lack of foresight and a lack of real maturity on some level.
And to the opposite.
One thing that was interesting,
go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say that the former head of security at Facebook, Alex Damos, was really one of the most interesting interviews because he had just recently left and he was so candid. And he said that one of the problems structurally with the company early on was that they had many of the talented folks working on product development were really very separate from the security folks, who were the people that were thinking about the harms.
Mm.
And so the product folks just were never exposed to think, they weren't forced to think about harms. And so one of the things that they've done recently is actually kind of handed over some of the responsibility of safety and security to those product managers and product developers, so that they have to be more thoughtful in their engineering, which I think on the one hand is a little frightening because those people aren't used to doing that.
Right.
But it's really organizationally wise because we all have to start doing that. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, engineers and folks in Silicon Valley need to start thinking about their role in society with greater responsibility, kind of the way that traditionally doctors and lawyers have thought of their role. We interviewed someone who didn't actually make it into the film, Jonathan Zittrain, who's talked quite a lot about this idea that there needs to be a greater sense that they are serving the public and not just their company or their product.
Just tuning in, we're talking with Anya Borg. She is one of the producers for Frontline's Facebook Dilemma. First hour was last night. Second hour is tonight on SDPB-TV at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. And let's talk a little bit about Sheryl Sandberg, because when she comes in, this is a particular time, again, in the history of a company. They're getting ready for, to go public. They have to have a business model that, you know, that makes those shareholders some kind of money. She comes in, and the part that she plays turns out to be very important. How so?
Well, Sheryl actually came into the company in, I believe, 2008 or 2009, and she had been at Google and had really developed the business model at Google and made it the success that it was. And so when she came into Facebook, it was really to think about how they were going to become a business. And in the years leading up to the IPO, there was, I think, a real sense of, you know, how could this platform that was free, a free service, really best monetize and figure out how to become a public company. And I think they realized at some point that the value that they had was all of this information about their users. And, you know, it's not just Facebook. This is really a problem across internet platforms that you know, we've all just gotten so used to the idea that advertising is the fuel of the internet economy, but there's a real exchange happening there. So, and I think Sheryl Sandberg, to your question, led a lot of the early decisions around how they were going to treat user data, how they were going to look for ways to, you know, they have a genuine idea, and I think it came from a place of really thinking, we want to show you relevant ads. So if you have dogs, we don't want to show you ads for cat food. And, you know, you can sort of understand the logic in that. But what's required is you really have to know a lot about people to show them ads that are so relevant to them. But the more that the company has amassed information about people, the more I think we all need to be thinking about, are they protecting that information? And what are the implications of any of these companies knowing so much about all of us?
Yeah. And there's a law student who sort of, you know, at some point says, I want a copy of all my data. Everything that you have, send it to me about me. And he gets that request, and he finds that there is an astonishing amount of what they would call commercially relevant data, but what he would call deeply private information. Mm-hmm. And he's another one of those voices who tries to sort of, you know, be a sounding call for what's going on, and is also sort of pushed to the side a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Max Schrems is a fascinating guy. So he was a law student in Austria who has spent a semester at Santa Clara University. And he says that, one day in class, they had a lawyer for Google. This was back in 2011. A lawyer for Facebook, excuse me, came to class and said, oh, in Europe they have privacy laws, but don't worry about it. They don't really enforce it. And he heard that, and his ears pricked up because he was the only European in the room. So he went back to Austria, and he thought, I want to know what Facebook has on me. I think he was 24 at the time. And so he started filing requests with Facebook for his data. And I think he said it was something like 22 rounds that he had to go back and forth. And finally, they just sent him a disk with all the data on it. And he was astonished. I mean, they had everything from, you know, all of his likes, all of his, trying to remember the specifics now. The thing that surprised him most, I think, was that they kept all of his personal deleted messages. Yeah. So he'd had long conversations that he thought he deleted but were actually part of the saved information. But what's fascinating about Max is that he has really gone on to do a lot more of the work around privacy law in Europe and is a huge part of the recent privacy legislation, GDPR, that the EU passed. So he's had an incredible role in this conversation.
Take me to Ukraine, because this is another story that, you know, I thought I knew, and then you watch it, and you're like, oh, I didn't know that. So unpack that for us a little bit.
Sure. So from the folks on the ground in Ukraine that we spoke with, the story as they told it was that their experience was that when the conflict began in Ukraine after the invasion of Crimea, the internet and social media. And social media in Ukraine is there's Facebook, there's also something called VKontakte and Twitter, that all of them started becoming filled with confusing news stories. So if you remember, the invasion of Crimea was this strange moment where Russian soldiers actually appeared in the center of town in Crimea wearing green uniforms with no insignia. Mm-hmm. So there was already a lot of confusion amongst the populace as to what was happening. And then sort of fake news stories began to circulate. The other thing that happened that we weren't able to mention in the film but was very important was that in this moment where people were really searching for information, a lot of the very prominent Ukrainian activists and journalists who had blogs and posted online and on Facebook began to, in huge numbers, get blocked from Facebook's site. And so folks in Ukraine thought that there was something happening where Russia was sort of reporting misuse of the platform, and they were just taking down these very important Ukrainian voices. So it was just this, you know, there's essentially a war happening, and nobody can find the right information. Mm. One really critical example of that was that there was a plane shot down in the summer, I can't remember what month now, of 2014, and there was like 10 different stories that went viral online about who shot down this plane. And so people were just left really searching and very confused for answers.
And because
it turned out that, yeah, go on.
Because of how Facebook is set up, these people who are trying to spread the disinformation can actually test what people will believe and hone their message very, very quickly based on what people are buying into as far as, you know, what is the divisive and, you know, literally fake. I mean, there's staged newscasts with actors, and it's a very deliberate intentional way to misinform a populace.
It is, and I think from what our reporting bore out is that, this Ukraine has been used as a testing site to some extent for hybrid war, cyber war activities that obviously we saw in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Who knows what's right. coming next. But that's what was interesting about that story. So at the time, one of the people we interview in the film was a very close advisor to the president in Ukraine, who was really concerned about what they were seeing on Facebook, and reached out to Facebook to say, "We need your help. We need an office in Ukraine. You're an important information source, and people are spreading. You know, there are fake accounts that are spreading disinformation on the site, and there are activists and journalists who are being silenced in large numbers." And Facebook initially sent two people to meet with him. I'm trying to remember now, I think it was the summer or the spring of 2015. And he said that they basically handed him a copy of Facebook's community standards and said, "We're an open platform and we believe in free speech and we don't silence people," which really gets at the heart of this dilemma, as we call it in the film, because, you know, from Facebook's perspective, I think, you know, for them to go in and start deciding who has the appropriate voice and what is the truth, and they're just, you know, how could they do that in every country in the world and every conflict in the world? That's why the scale of this is so overwhelming.
Yeah, and scale is a big issue. The scale of the ability to manipulate too. This is incredible work that you've done. In about a minute, if you could preview sort of what the next episode tonight is like. Where does the path lead next in the reporting?
Sure. Well, last night we left off in 2016. So tonight's hour is basically 2016 to the present. We go through the U.S. presidential election and the rise of what some people now call fake news, and the U.S. The Russian influence campaign on Facebook in the U.S. and that investigation. And then we also travel abroad to Southeast Asia, to the Philippines and Myanmar, to see some examples of how Facebook is having a really huge impact on people's lives there. And then we have the unique access to do some firsthand interviews with folks at Facebook and to get a sense of what they're up against, how they're approaching this.
It's a two-hour special Facebook Dilemma, two nights, last night and tonight. You can watch it at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV. It's called The Facebook Dilemma. My guest has been Anya Borg, frontline producer. Anya, thank you so much for all your time today. We really appreciate this. This is incredible work.
Thank you, Laurie. I enjoyed talking with you.